From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what will the new year hold for America's automakers?
The luxury market is just on fire.
Saluting the made in Michigan music that crossed the Atlantic to Great Britain, starting with Motown.
There was something joyous, wasn't there, about the sound of Motown? And it was like nothing we'd ever experienced here before. It was a hit factory.
Michigan-born writer Kathleen Flynn brings us a touching memoir of her family, all tied around treasured family recipes.
We really learn a lot about ourselves and where we come from the food we eat.
A story of a family and lots of wonderful recipes. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Motown, we think of it as the music that made Detroit, but it also spread around the world. I'm Cynthia Canty. How one city's sound influenced an entire generation. But first, 2014 was quite the year for the world's automakers, full of good news and some very, very bad news. Michelle Krebs is Director of Automotive Relations with the Auto Trader Group, and Tracy Samilton is Michigan Radio's auto reporter. Great to have you both here.
Thank you for having me.
And happy to be here.
Let's start with recalls. We knew that we were at 56 million vehicles recalled in this country in October, and that was before Takata. Mm-hmm. So we're like pushing 60 million. Michelle, give us a little context. If we're talking something like 60 million recalls, how does that compare with the number of cars and trucks that we bought in this country in 2014?
Well, it's a lot more. It's almost three times more, depending on where we come in. It looks like this year we'll probably sell 16.5 million new cars. So it's a lot of recalls.
All-time high.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and I can tell you, I've talked to dealers who are the ones having to do the work. They are just beyond, stressed. They are so slammed with the work. Long, long waits for some people to get their cars fixed. And then people who just have regular maintenance, they're having trouble getting them in. It's a real mess at some of these dealerships. They are really under a lot of pressure.
And they don't always have the fixes or the parts. For example, the latest recall with the Takata airbags, we aren't really sure what's causing that problem. There were theories before, but now that's being looked at by all the automakers teaming together. And, some of the fixes just aren't ready for dealers yet.
Well, in fact, let me ask you, either one of you, if I'm let's say you're driving that car that you know has one of those affected Takata airbags. Would you park it, which is certainly not feasible for most people? They need their vehicle. Do you show up demanding a fix? Is there a fix?
There isn't going to be for a couple of years for most people, for at least 2 years, if just Takata is the company that's making these airbags. And, the risk is tiny. All right, the risk is truly tiny, but at the same time, it's a terrifying scenario.
If you're the unlucky person, even if it is a tiny risk, it is. It's pretty horrifying. Well, we can't talk about 2014 without talking about GM's ignition gate, as it was called, and they're confirming at least 42 people have died, 58 hurt in crashes related to the defective ignition switches. Recall cost hopping $400 million, yet Tracy, sales are outstanding for GM. So what gives?
People are giving General Motors and the new CEO, Mary Barra, who's been out in front of this situation, I think people are saying the company is trying to do the right thing. That has to be it. They're not being punished, as far as I can see, in terms of the sales.
The other thing that goes with that is, if this is also the year of the recalls on the downsize, the upside, especially for Detroit automakers, is this is the year of the truck again. We are just seeing booming pickup truck and sport utility sales, and General Motors has been a huge beneficiary of that boom.
I got to wonder, with white-hot light of bad publicity that GM got, how much of that has driven subsequent recalls from everybody? Would we have seen as many recalls, I guess I'm wondering, without ignition gate, Tracy?
Yeah, I think it was probably a big driver. Nobody wants to be the next CEO in the hot seat in Congress. Nobody wants to be there. That was painful to watch. It was certainly probably more painful to be Mary Barra than watch her go through that. But nobody wants to be there.
And we saw the same thing happen with the Toyota recalls back in 2009, 2010, everybody right afterwards and during that were doing recalls right and left, not as many as now, but they did exactly for what as Tracy points out, they do not want to be accused by the government of dragging their feet or knowing something a long time ago that they didn't address. So, yes, everybody's very quick on the trigger to do a recall.
Michelle, the new guard at GM and Ford, certainly, as you just referred to, there was nothing, I think, more excruciating to watch than Mary Barra. How do you rate how she's done?
Well, I think she's done very well. Certainly the people affected by the faulty ignition switches don't think so. But I thought she did as well as could be expected. I thought she did well in front of Congress. I think when she was at her very best was when we saw her, and Tracy was there, we saw her in front of the employees at a town hall meeting. We got to watch it from the video cameras. But she was impassioned about everybody's responsible for safety. She raised the level of what we can be to the employees. I thought it was probably her best speech, but then the public side is not as emotional.
Yeah, and you know, I was particularly struck by her saying, look, if you think you have a safety problem, you take it to your supervisor and you still think it's not being dealt with, I want you to contact me. She's the CEO of one of the largest companies in the world. She says, you send the email to me. And I think she meant that.
And then Ford got a new CEO. Alan Mulally steps down. And Mark Fields comes in. And profits kind of took a nosebleed. Right.
He's
after
certainly
he came.
Not yeah. personally responsible for
not
that.
At all.
It was just timing. That's a little tough. That's a little tough to have a brand new job and then you suddenly have to give your investors some bad news about the,
and what
the profits.
What were behind the profits in that quarter, Michelle?
Well, a deteriorating Europe. Europe's been tough. And in particular, the mess in Russia hurt Ford. And then, you know, South America's not very strong right now either. A lot of different issues, including currency fluctuations. But, Mark Fields, from the start, had big shoes to fill, and, boy, he got it in spades the very next quarter. The other thing is they're in, and we knew this was coming, they're in this very tricky dance of switching from the old Ford F-150 to the new aluminum-bodied F-150 for 2015, and that took down a plant for a long time, and that's their biggest selling vehicle. It's the biggest selling vehicle in the United States, so their profits were hurt as a result of that. Now, if they get through that and that vehicle is successful, then he gets to ride the wave in 2015.
And you touched on this, Tracy, as we talked about GM and the fact that you're looking at, you know, some great sales. But overall for GM, that's not just the case for GM. Looking at, what, $16.5 million for sales this year? That has to be, you know, one of the biggest stories out of 2014.
Yeah, if that's not a full recovery, I don't know what is. And and next year it looks like it's going to be just a little bit more than that, and we might see a drop off after that.
We could hit 17 million next year, which would be phenomenal. And you know, the Detroit automakers have been big beneficiaries. Look at Chrysler. The big story at Chrysler has been that little Jeep Cherokee that has just taken the market by storm. So done very, very well.
Chrysler in general, their sales just every month. We keep, you know, Michelle, you and I have talked a lot about this every month. I'm like, when are they going to stop growing? I mean, they have just regained so much of their market share since the bankruptcy. It's just phenomenal in terms of the customer response to the new vehicles they have.
Where have sales not been as robust? Who might we say would be the losers in the sales picture for 2014, Michelle?
Any car company that sells only cars and doesn't sell trucks and sport utilities.
Small cars.
Volkswagen continued to struggle. Hyundai and Kia, because they don't have a pickup truck, have struggled. And if you didn't have new product. The other ones that have been a big winner have been the luxury car makers. The luxury market is just on fire, and it's phenomenal. We could hit close to 2 million vehicles in the luxury segment, and that doesn't mean just cars. That means it's all fueled mostly by those little luxury sport utilities that are coming onto the market.
So it's cool to enjoy luxury and some conspicuous consumption again.
It's back. It's okay.
And of course, helping all of that along is the fact that as we pull up at the gas pump, we're all smiling. Can't love it enough, and I'm hearing it could go lower, gas prices.
I'm hearing that as well, low through next year. It's not necessarily good news for companies that have big plans for a hybrid vehicle that they want to introduce next year or an electric vehicle. People tend to be pretty sensitive to gas prices when they are thinking about, especially if that car is significantly more expensive than the regular version of the car. You can't make that cost-benefit analysis very much at $2.30 a gallon.
But yeah, you just have to feel, Michelle, for the R&D people and the teams developing these, because you can't just do that at the drop of the hat. And we all know that OPEC could tighten up the supply and prices could jump up again, albeit we're at a lower base. But you know, it takes time to get that electric car out on the market, and then meantime we're all going, no, we want that big sport ute.
Yes, but here's the thing too, that also is a dilemma for the car companies. They have to meet very stringent 2016 fuel economy standards that get only more stringent in 2025. There will be a review of those in 2017, but it's also driven, so they're developing these cars to meet regulations, and the dilemma is, but consumers don't want to buy them.
What's the one thing you're really going to be watching for in the new year? Michelle, go.
Well, I'm going to watch for gas prices, but the other thing we have to watch is interest rates, because one of the reasons the market is so hot is credit has been widely available and it's dirt cheap.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, because that is a big, big driver of sales. And right now I could go get a new car and pay, 3.5% interest.
What are you going to watch for, Tracy, in the new year?
Well, I'm looking forward to the new Volt. I'm really curious to see what they're going to do to make this car less of a technology showcase and more of an actual car, you know, that people can find pleasure in, maybe putting a third person in the back seat instead of the two people crammed in there. So I'm looking forward to that at the Detroit Auto Show, seeing that car.
Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio's auto reporter, and Michelle Krebs from autotrader.com. Always great talking cars with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good is the beguiling title of the latest book from writer Kathleen Flynn. It's billed as a memoir of food and love for an American Midwest family. That Midwest she writes about is largely the family farm near Flint in Davison. The Flynns and good food seem to go together. Where you found one, you'd find the other. You get a wonderful, loving story of a Michigan family, and you get recipes, lots of great recipes, which is what one would expect from the author of The Sharper Your Knife, The Less You Cry, and The Kitchen Counter Cooking School. Kathleen Flynn, good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, in your first book, The Sharper Your Knife, The Less You Cry, you tell us the story of going through Le Cordon Bleu in Paris. And it seems that Burnt Toast is kind of like the prequel. We meet your parents and your grandparents and your great-grandparents, and we find out why cooking is literally in your blood.
That's a great way to describe it, actually. I hadn't thought about it until recently that it's sort of a prequel. But I think that's true. I really went back. I started thinking about doing this book when I was actually writing The Sharper Your Knife, because I was surprised how often I would come back to these stories in the farm. I mean, even in Sharper, I have my mother talking about her minestrone soup and the chickens and all kinds of stuff. And in my second book, I did too. And I thought, you know, I really want to kind of dig in there and find out more about my background and more about all these cooks I keep hearing about. And it was surprising. I found that in every generation, people cooked for a living in my family, going all the way back to my great-great-grandmother, who arrived from Sweden in 1890 with a single suitcase at the age of 17. I also found some other surprising things, such as the fact that one of my grandfathers is a bootlegger and that my last name shouldn't really be Flynn. So when you go digging around for those recipes, people, just remember you might find more than you bargained for.
Now, you're the youngest of five kids. And so much of what the story you tell happened long before you arrived. And I'm wondering how much digging and research it took to really get all those great details of your family's history.
You know, it's really interesting. I had asked my mother over the years, because I started thinking about this book 5 years ago, and I would say, oh, you know, what about this, Mom? What about that? And then one day I asked her about my dad's chicken and biscuits recipe, and I said, do you have that anywhere? And she said, you know, I think I might have written about that. And so she went to one of her many closets in her house and pulled down this box, and I had never seen the box before. And it was filled with all these stories that she had written over the course of about 30 years about their life on the farm, about memories of her grandmother, about stories my father told her about his childhood during the Great Depression. And I just said, Mom, I can't believe that you've never shared these with me. I mean, for one, I'm a memoir writer for crying out loud, you know, this stuff is really useful. And she said, oh, well, you know, I'm not a real writer. I didn't want to show it to you. I didn't think it was any good. And I went through and it, I mean, for a project like this, it was a treasure trove, you know what I mean? It was extraordinary detail stuff. A lot of times she'd written it around the time that it had happened. And so when people ask me exactly that question, like, how did you have so much detail about stuff that happened before you were born? Well, that was why. I mean, and a lot of those stories make up the core of the book. And then I did additional interviewing with her and also other members of the family, including my father's only surviving sibling, which was his much younger sister. And she had a lot of details that she filled in as well.
Kathleen, what led you to see your family's story as something special enough that you really wanted to write this book and share it with everyone, and also to serve up all those recipes and really tie your family's story and all the love everyone had for everybody with food?
You know, it's what's interesting about it is I don't know how remarkable my family really is. I think that they're remarkable in the way that a lot of, if not most, American families are. I mean, they start with this immigrant story. I mean, people who were willing to make extraordinary sacrifices and to give up everything to try to find not often even a better life for themselves, but for the people who came after them. I mean, I look at my grandmother, my great-great-grandmother, who came over from Sweden, and she came over, worked as a housemaid, and then as a cook when she found out they made a little bit more money. And she worked really hard and saved all of her money so that her two brothers could come over. And then the three of them worked really hard and saved all of their money so that the rest of their seven siblings and their parents could move to America. And I kind of look at that and I think, you know, everyone has that story somewhere in their past. And so even though I like to think my family is this kind of quirky, plucky lot, you know, who worked really hard and had these really wonderful values. And my grandparents in particular, they kind of cultivated this really strong culture of generosity. And I think that was also a message I wanted to share. I think that that was something that was a much more common element in kind of our general communities and so on, just even a generation or two ago. And I really wanted to resurface that to show what a wonderful life you can have by, you know, giving a lot of things away and being very generous. So while it's, I think, a nice story about my family, and I'm happy that I did that, I'm happy I did it for them, but I really also wanted other people to look at my story and say, wow, that really reminds me of mine, you know, and to find their own, kind of think more about their own roots and the people that went before them and really think about why maybe they have a certain dish on a particular holiday, or why they always have, say, fish on Friday, or, you know, that great casserole recipe that their great aunt passed down. Maybe think more about where all of that came from, because we really learn a lot about ourselves and where we come from the food we eat.
And speaking of learning about where we come from, one of my very favorite stories in your book came right off the bat as you tell us how your parents, Milt and Irene, met. He was at Michigan State University after he'd served in Korea, and she was a secretary. And one night, they both wound up at a roller rink near Lansing, and your dad knocked your mom down, and he took a look at her and asked her out. Would you read us the excerpt from Burnt Toast? Tell us what happened next.
Mom couldn't believe her luck that such a smart, handsome college guy wanted to date her. As she confided the story to a coworker her age attending his college, the woman just shook her head and put her hand up to silence her. "Listen, I wouldn't get my hopes up," she said flatly to my mom as she fixed the circle pin on her shirt. "Don't you know that he's dating the water carnival queen? They're the big item around campus. I heard they're getting engaged." The queen was a leggy, glamorous blonde. Her beauty was legend around Lansing. Mom decided to check out her competition. She learned the beauty queen frequented a certain hair salon on Saturday mornings. With the deft nonchalance of a detective, she feigned waiting for a bus across the street until the blonde turned up.
Mom watched her walk with the practiced poise of someone comfortable with being on display. Her dimpled smile showed off perfect, brilliant white teeth that matched her perfect, delicate gloves. Mom felt beaten. She got on the next bus that arrived, even though she had no idea where it was going. As she took a seat, she gulped back tears. How could I be so stupid? She thought on the bus as it pulled away, leaving the blonde in the distance. She's like a movie star. I don't stand a chance. After a few dates, Dad pulled into the drive-in movie theater. They'd brought along their own popcorn. He asked Mom to hold the paper bag, and when he took it back, it spilled all over them. Irene, I've got something to say, he started nervously. Here it comes, Mom thought. He's going to dump me. I've been trying to figure out a way to ask you to. He paused and took a deep breath. Will you marry me? He blurted. But what about the water carnival queen? Mom asked, incredulous. Are you kidding me? He responded, dumbfounded. He took her hands gently in his. You're the brightest, most beautiful woman that I've ever met. I knew you were the one for me the minute that I picked you up off that rink.
Just wonderful. That's writer Kathleen Flynn reading from her memoir, Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good, a memoir of food and love for an American Midwest family. Kathleen, what does the title mean, Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good?
That refers to my grandmother, who would actually didn't believe in any kind of newfangled fad, such as, say, toasters would be some anything like that. I mean, she was kind of a hand-whipping kind of lady. And so she would take her toast and she would put it into the racks in the oven and just kind of put it under the broiler. Because, you know, she felt like, hey, I make my own bread. I can certainly toast it. Like, how hard can that be? But, of course, she'd always get distracted. And then she would end up burning a bunch of it and she'd give it out to small kids because she wouldn't waste food either. I mean, they lived on a farm and, you know, food was really valuable. And so she would make up stuff. And among her most famous ones was, oh, eat the burnt toast. That makes you sing good. I mean, everybody knows that. And maybe there's something to it. I mean, all my family can sing. Like, we all have sort of decent singing voice. I mean, we're not the Von Trapps or anything, you know, but we certainly can, you know, all carry a tune and we all like to sing. And maybe that had something to do with it.
Every chapter you end with a selection of recipes tied in. So we have everything from Grandma Inez's pancakes to the spaghetti sauce your dad made at his restaurant in San Francisco. And our producer, Ellie Billings, made your mom's recipe for Candy Girl Moist Oatmeal cookies. So I have to tell you, I'm going to try it now. It's here, and boy, they are moist. So as I try one of these cookies, tell us your memory of them.
Oh, it's sort of an embarrassing one, really.
Go for it. It's good. Mm.
Oh, good.
Moist.
Mm-mm. Yes. So we moved away from the farm when I was about 7 years old, and we moved into, and I put air quotes around it, town, because it was about 1,200 people who lived in this little town, and we moved into this house, and it seemed really fancy, and although I was back there recently, and I decided it's not very fancy at all, but I walked around the neighbor, I thought, oh, my mom had said something about, you know, going and calling on the neighbors, and so I decided that I would go and meet the neighbors one night when they were out. And I dressed in my best cowgirl outfit, which is disturbing because I actually had more than one. And
so
matching
did I,
hat.
By the way.
Did you?
I
awesome.
Did.
Right?
Yep.
We used to go to the thrift store all the time and see when there were always cowgirl outfits. I had all these cowgirl outfits. And I got a basket and I went into my mom's cookie jar and I put all these cookies in the jar. And I walked around to the different houses and introduced myself and gave people cookies, which now I just think, what a freak. I don't know what came over me that seemed like such a good idea. But one of the women across the street, and completely randomly, she came to one of my book events in Davison when I was back there. And she said, I remember that because it was such a weird thing that you did that. But I did it apparently for about a week where I went around and met all these people.
The ambassador of goodwill from the Flynn family.
Yeah, but it's funny. So the very first time I did that, though, I these were the cookies.
I have to tell you, they're so moist and so yummy. And I know you say in your recipe to actually kind of cook the raisins a little before you put them in. And Ellie did that. And they're like plump and delicious.
Yeah, it really makes a big difference. I've also done it with craisins, and that's really a nice kind of substitute as well. So
I have to tell you, full disclosure here, Kathleen, I read your book. I always take reading with me, and I was on a mini vacation in Siesta Key, Florida, not even knowing your story was going to wind up on Anna Maria Island. I gobbled up your book in a couple of days. I loved everyone in your family. Your dad and my dad share the same name, so I guess there was that for it because I could kind of project. But we were looking to take a drive on the Sunday before we came home, and I said to my husband, I want to go through Cortez and take me on to Anna Maria Island. And I think about the fact that your dad had to be dragged kicking and screaming to Florida for vacation because he thought vacation meant hunting up in northern Michigan.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think?
Well, I loved Anna Maria Island. Oh, it was wonderful. Just, I've got a picture that I put up of just smiling in the sunshine on the beach. And I thought about how many Michigan families did exactly what your mom and dad did. They find their slice of retirement heaven in Florida, but still have those Michigan roots.
Yeah, I think that it's funny whenever we walk the beach at night, and my mom do it almost every night that I'm in Florida, and I spend a few months there every year now because I bought a house there years ago, and we always talk about how the island is my dad's legacy to us, that we were so lucky, you know, to be able to, I think about this a lot, that I was very lucky to have grown up in Michigan and experienced that life. And it's a good life. Like, I went back to Davison and did a couple of events for my book. And there were all these people, like my cousins and their friends. And I looked around and I talked to all of them and wondered, what would my life be like if I had stayed in Davison instead of moving to Florida? And I thought, you know, it probably would have been great. I mean, it's a good life, you know? I mean,
sure.
It would have been my parents' life in many ways. I mean, going fishing and going hunting and all of that. And in fact, I think this whole book and going back home and made me really want to spend more time in Michigan. And I took my husband there and he loved it. But by going to Florida, I think that those few years I spent there before I turned 18 and then, you know, kind of spending a lot of my adult life around Florida, it made me realize there was a big world out there. I think having that sort of dual hometown in a way, you know, being exposed to very different sort of lives and, you know, different kind of lifestyles made me really, I think, long to see more of the world. And maybe that explains why I ended up in Paris eventually.
Yeah.
Would I have still gone to Paris if I stayed in Michigan? I don't know, really. I'll never know.
No.
But I'm lucky that I have a beach to walk on and my mom still lives there and that we have that to share. But then during the summer, you know, I plan to spend a lot more time in Michigan.
What do you love about writing?
That's a great question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that before. I don't know that I've ever thought about it because I always wrote from the time I basically learned how to read. And before I learned how to read and write, I used to tell stories. And my mom said I would be this tiny little, like, 3 or 4 year old and coming up with these crazy. My mom would be like, where did you come up with that? No. I guess what I like about writing to me is that they say that writers live twice. And, you know, that's certainly true if you write memoirs. And I feel that in a lot of ways by writing about, say, growing up on the farm or going to Paris or even the experience of teaching other people to cook, like I did in my second book, it's really made me think more about the life that I'm living and reflect on it in a way that I think we often don't pause and take the time to do. And I like to share stories about other people because I often think I'm not really sure how interesting I am. I think that other people are always really interesting. And I just think everyone has a story and you can learn something from everyone.
Well, we certainly learn about your family. And I have to say, I was laughing. I wiped away some tears and I cannot wait to try more of these recipes. And I want to thank Allie Billings, our producer, for making your delicious cookies because they really are terrific. And we want to let everybody know we have put the recipe for the Candy Girl Moist Oatmeal Cookies up on our website. Kathleen Flynn's book is Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good, a memoir of food and love for an American Midwest family. Kathleen, it was really, really a great read and it was great to talk with you.
It's no secret that Michigan has turned out some pretty powerful figures in the world of pop music, musicians and artists whose influence rocketed out of Michigan and spread around the world to places like the United Kingdom. So many artists there were influenced by R&B and Motown music, the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, and so many more on through the years. Well, we wondered what specific influence Michigan artists and music have had in the UK, and for that, we are happy to say hello to Chris Hawkins. He's a music journalist, and he's a host on BBC Radio 6 Music, and he joins us now from Manchester. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Cindy.
It's good to have you with us. You know, Chris, I think about the beginnings of this kind of love affair that British kids had with American R&B and Motown music. And, you know, we take for granted internet streaming. Click on, you know, your smartphone or your iPad or your laptop and you can hear music from all over the world. But when these British kids were first getting wind of R&B and Motown, that certainly wasn't the case. How'd they discover it?
Well, it was all about vinyl, of course, in those days. And in the clubs, it relied upon DJs travelling from the States to the UK and UK DJs travelling to the States, hearing the sounds and physically bringing them back. As you say, it's all about streaming these days. And I think it's staggering. I was doing some research talking to some teenagers in the UK recently, and they had no concept of owning a record collection, which is a completely alien idea to me. And I guess it is to you, too.
Yes.
The idea of not having a physical collection. They think it's ludicrous. Why would you buy your music when you can get it all for free? At least you can listen to every single song you want. And in their minds, and they're probably right, there is not going to be a time when they can't get music for free.
Isn't that something?
Isn't that weird? Well, because I love opening up the sleeve of a CD these days. And in the past, I loved flicking through my vinyl.
Yeah, well, and the other thing it did is it let you explore things that you didn't even know were there. You would open up a record,
right,
and there would be all the sides on each side of the album, all the songs on each side of the album. So it wasn't just, well, I like this one and this one and this one, and picking the track that you want to add to your collection of MP3s.
Totally, and very often spending your pocket money on records because you like the sleeve. You go to a record store on a Saturday, check through what you were really interested in, and then you might look over, you might have gone for one particular record, but really liked the cover of another and bought it on that basis alone.
Well, I know when, Chris, when Sir Paul McCartney came to Detroit, came here to Michigan in 2011, he played a huge concert at our baseball stadium at Comerica Park. And before the show, he made a specific request and a point of touring Hitsville, USA, which is that little house that was home to Motown. And while he was on the tour, he's found a battered old Steinway piano. It was right there in Studio A. And he asked to play it. And they said, oh, it's just in such terrible shape, it can't be played. And Sir Paul went, really? And then he paid to have that piano shipped to New York to Steinway, paid to have it rebuilt, and then he played it at a benefit concert for the Motown Museum, all because he loved Motown music so much. And does that kind of thing surprise you?
Well, perhaps to a point. It's an extreme thing to do, and you have to have a lot of money to be able to do it. But I think that's a great thing, isn't it? That's paying back the dues that the Beatles perhaps owed to, if not Motown, but to the music of an amazing city in an amazing state.
What other artists do you think were heavily influenced by the music that came out of, we'll say out of Detroit, because we were talking about these early days, and I think Motown was the big, big thing out of Detroit.
Yeah, of course. So let's pick an example. Let's say Tears of a Clown, Smokey Robinson. Okay, quintessential for me at least, and I think for perhaps anyone in the UK. You may beg to differ, but I think you'll probably agree. Quintessential Motown artist, right?
Yes, very much so.
Perfect Motown soul act. He was on the Ready, Steady, Go Motown special, which pretty much broke all Motown acts here in the UK. And with that music by Stevie Wonder, the lyrics by Smokey, that song has everything.
I was also told when I interviewed Martha Reeves, she was very clear that she and the Vandellas had a huge following in England when Dancing in the Streets first broke in the 60s. But even when I sat down and talked with her 10 years or so ago, she was still drawing big crowds whenever she'd come over and play in England. Her loyal English fans.
Yeah, I went to see her. Yeah, I saw her not too many years ago, but in the last 10 years. And you know what? That felt like being a part of something very special. It was one of those nights where you just thought, there are not going to be too many more chances to experience this. And she was still brilliant now.
Well,
and you think about not just what she has achieved and what the music that she and they made, but but what a bigger picture she was a part of, and that factory, that unrelenting music machine that was Motown.
Yeah. I was also told a story by a kid from Manchester who made it big, and that was Peter Noon, who was Hermit of Hermit's Hermits. And
yeah.
When the Hermits were huge at the really peak of their career, and they packed Olympia Stadium in Detroit with Screaming Girls, of which I was one. After the concert, Peter Noon told me he went to Hitsville. He didn't have an appointment. They didn't let him in. They were recording at whatever time. And he said he just sat on the porch just to soak it up.
Yeah.
And again, it struck me of how much passion artists from England had for this music. What was it, do you think, about this Motown sound that just made them go, wow? What was it replacing, and what spoke to them?
That's a very good question, because we were, of course, coming out of a period of 50s rock and roll, and through the 60s, the Beatles, as you were talking about, the Beatles breaking through. And then there was something new. Can you describe it from your side? Because I think you probably have a different perspective. I'd be interested to hear what you think it was, from as an American, what you think it was that made it so appealing.
It was the production. I think it was that incredible wall of sound that the Funk Brothers offered up every time that they played on track. So it was just that like Dancing in the Streets, for instance. It was just, it captured the moment in America, and it spoke to everybody in many ways, whether it was let's have a great time, or there were others who saw Dancing in the Street as a call to civil rights, action. So it just was some kind of a wonderfully universal sound that just kind of shook it up. The way that when the Beatles came here, that shook everything up. So instead of crooners like Bobby Vinton or Bobby Rydell or, that kind of softer sound, bam, here comes this new sound.
And there was something joyous, wasn't there, about the sound of Motown? Something joyous, but as you say, the lyrics often a little more complicated, a little more deep, a lot more to the writing in some cases too. And it was like nothing we'd ever experienced here before. It was a hit factory, and it was a reliable source of music too, because it was hit after hit, and it made artists huge stars, and we adopted those stars in many ways here too. Going back to Tears of a Clown, I think I'm right in saying this, you may know otherwise, but I think it was a B-side. Certainly when it was released here in the UK, and it was actually an English woman who was head of the Motown fan club in the UK who insisted that it would be a great single and was wasted as a B-side, and that's how it got known.
And there you go. Somebody just acted. And in fact, speaking of an individual person with a lot of influence, we ought to talk a little about in those early days as these bands were coming out of England and trying to break into America, it was Detroit Radio, or really Windsor, CKLW in Windsor, and a woman named Rosalie Trombley, who was their program director, who heard My Generation and Can't Explain and these early songs and said, I'm playing them on my station. And it was a huge station. And I think there are a lot of UK artists who credit that woman and that radio station for getting them off the ground in America.
That's an amazing thing, isn't it, having that kind of history and to think that there is one person perhaps that could be deemed responsible for changing the face and the sound of music.
Yeah, yeah. Pete Townsend of The Who is always very open in praising Detroit for launching The Who, and you will find it isn't hard to find Detroiters who saw the Rolling Stones and saw The Who playing at Southfield High School when they were just starting to make it in America, and then later the Grandy Ballroom, which was a legendary rock club in Detroit. Then moving through these decades, from the Motown glory days, Chris, what do you see as some other artists or songs from Michigan that really, really had big impact in the UK?
Well, I'd like to come back to the blues, but let's talk about perhaps punk and The Stooges, No Fun.
Oh,
what
yeah.
a song. What an amazing piece of music. It's a game changer, isn't it? An incredible piece of music. And I think I'm right in saying that this is what came before the Ramones. This was long before the Sex Pistols too.
Yes.
This was it. This was the beginning, not just a change in music, but the change to a culture, a cultural phenomenon.
You're right, it was a sea shift, and Iggy's still chugging away.
Well, the wonderful thing that you have given us, and I mean very specifically at BBC Radio 6 Music, is Iggy Pop, because he's a colleague of mine at 6 Music and presents a show every Sunday afternoon.
And he's from right here in the Ann Arbor area, so we'll
absolutely. Have you seen him play?
I have not myself. I know people, there are people who have huge influence, and I hear it's an incredible experience.
Yeah, I think we've got Iggy to thank for stage diving. I think if anyone can ever be responsible for being the first person to stage dive, it may have been Iggy.
Now, another artist from Michigan, started in Bay City and then grew up in Rochester Hills, Madonna Louise Ciccone. And what an impact she's had.
Well, in terms of Michigan music sparking a response in the UK, I don't know that any artist has been more popular than Madonna. There have been those that may have matched her, but in terms of her music and popular culture, she has icon status. Vogue, it was, that took moves from the underground gay clubs into the horrid, as I remember, little night spots that I used to go to in the small town where I grew up. Everyone was voguing, and I remember nights at this particular club, I'll name it Park Lane, in a small town called Shrewsbury, where the DJ would put on Vogue, and I can remember vividly standing at the bar watching inebriated friends and locals attempting to Vogue, and those sights will live in my nightmares forever, Cindy.
I'm speaking with Chris Hawkins, who's a music journalist, and he's a host on BBC Radio 6 Music, as we explore the impact of Michigan artists on UK fans and UK artists. Now, I'm interested in Eminem. He just actually recently sold out Comerica Park for two solid nights, he and Rihanna playing together. How much impact and influence is Eminem having on in the UK?
Do you know, I remember playing My Name Is on the radio for the very first time. I was doing a Saturday afternoon show on the BBC's radio station for London. And I remember the producer, I remember this so clearly, the producer of the programme came to me. The show started at 2 p.m. And at 1:45 that afternoon, he'd been dropped off a single by the record company and told it would be good to get this on the air as soon as possible because this guy's going to be big news. And I can remember the sleeve, it was red and white, and it said My Name Is on it. So we listened to it very quickly. We put it on and thought, okay, right, this is going to be massive. Is it really going to be massive? It didn't really feel like it was going to be a big record. But we played it on the show. The reaction was mixed, as you can probably imagine. But of course, he went on to be huge. And I remember seeing him at Milton Keynes Bowl the last time he played in the UK. And I remember Cypress Hill was supporting. I remember him not only being of superstar status at the time,
yeah,
he had an aura about him and he had attitude. And I remember, if this is any gauge of how popular and how sold out that gig was, it took me 3.5 hours to get out of the car park afterwards.
Oh, that is a gauge. Oh, boy. How about Kid Rock? Now, I can tell you, the reason I'm asking this is because my family and I wind up going to Ireland often because we have relatives there. And I can remember being out in the tiniest corner in County Galway where it's Irish speaking and English is understood. And I walked in and what's playing is Kid Rock all summer long. And they were so impressed that I was from near where Kid Rock lives. So does he have a following in the UK?
Do you know what? I'm going to say, yes, he probably does, but he's not on my radar and he's not on any of my friends. I'm mid to late 30s. And I think that's Kid Rock is a successful artist on MOR radio. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's a big playlist artist. And that particular song, this time of year, of course, it's huge. But beyond that, I'm not sure that Kid Rock is a massive deal in the UK.
Yeah.
And as I say, certainly not for me and not for Six Music.
We have such a techno music scene that's coming out of Detroit and out of Southeast Michigan. And I have talked to these DJs who know that they have really, really avid UK fans. What kind of impact is Detroit's techno making?
Well, I think it all stems back. I'm going to take this right back to Strings of Life, Derek May, under the name Rhythm is Rhythm, okay? Mm-hmm. And you'll remember when this came out. He was a guy who was at school with a couple of friends who became the Belleville Three. And that track, it got its name from Frankie Knuckles, okay? And it basically sparks what we know as Acid House, okay? This is where it all started with that particular track. And that was a scene that, for me personally, it was just when I was starting to go out and I was aware of pub culture and club culture. And with that track came a different clubbing scene completely. A London club called Shoom opened in around about 1986-87. And it was DJ Danny Rampling's club, and he and his wife opened it. And it was a very different feel. It was a hazy fog. It was a kind of dreamy atmosphere, and the acid house music played. And that time here in the UK became to some the second summer of love and the smiley T-shirts. And then with that, in terms of culture, there was then this huge fear after the tabloid newspapers here supported this whole idea of the summer of love. Then came the recreational drug culture with it, and the tabloids turned completely on this kind of sound and blamed these DJs, these clubs, for the use of drugs in the UK in a big way for a fairly long period of time in the end.
Interesting. And I know again, thanks to the internet, so much can be explored and shared from country to country and across an ocean with a click. I would be interested, as someone who is a music journalist, who follows music, who plays music to audiences in England, Chris, would you be able to characterize or describe a Michigan sound?
Do you know what? I can, in a contemporary way.
Go.
The White Stripes.
Good point.
Yeah, okay, so there is Motown, of course, and we will have that forever. It's a musical treasure, the whole Motown sound. But you know what? I think the White Stripes do it, and I think they are incredible. They're one of my favourite bands of all time. I've seen them play live on a number of occasions. I think Jack White is as close to genius as it's possible to be. The guy is incredible, and with that garage blues sound, he does what maybe John Lee Hooker started in the 40s and has encapsulated a part of every scene since, and is a groundbreaking artist, and he knows how to make a great record. And I'm not talking about your Kid Rock mainstream sound.
Right, right.
I am talking about alternative music made in a way that it's impossible not to appreciate its brilliance.
Give me three adjectives that you would use to describe the White Stripes sound.
Innovative. Mm-hmm. Interesting. The next one has a hyphen. Mind-blowing.
There you go. You get it. Very fun to talk about music with you, Chris Hawkins, who's host on BBC Radio 6 Music, as we explore the influence that musicians and artists from Michigan have had in the UK. Chris, thanks for talking with us on Stateside. It's been a blast.
Thank you, Cindy. Great to talk to you.
And here at Stateside, we always like to hear from you. What are your thoughts about what's happening in the news? What stories do you think we need to tell? And what people should we profile? Let us know. You can find us very easily on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and that's spelled C-A-N-T-Y. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And of course, always on the website, look for the Stateside link at michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Zach Dieterman, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.